Welcome back to the CLL Happy Hour podcast. We got Dan Kaplan and myself, Kevin Brown, back here for another podcast with a couple special guests. Current guest here, we can say that now, as Dan Arestra makes his second appearance on the podcast. And we've got Water Dogs Senior Consultant of Locker Room Strategy and Operations, Nick Acello. Guys, what's happening?
Let's go. Let's go. This is going to be a good
happy
one.
Hour with this crew. Should be good. Should be a winner. I'm pumped.
Like we start all podcasts, let's start with what we're drinking. I'm going with a nice little Golden Monkey, starting off hot. Hoping to just keep it to one drink. We'll see how the pod goes.
Aren't those like 9% alcohol?
Oh, yeah. This way I don't have to go back to the fridge. Kaplan, what are you drinking?
I got something that is definitely not 9%. This is kind of your this is your go-to drink if you are someone who doesn't want like those IPAs, but also doesn't want to show up somewhere with like Miller Lights or something. So you go with the Big Wave from Kona. Got very a couple of left over from my guy Evan from the last time he was here like 2 years ago. So yeah.
Love it.
I've got a Budweiser that says freedom right on the can, and that's what you drink if you like freedom. So that's what I'm drinking.
Marketing beer to Americans has got to be like the best job ever. Just put freedom on the cans and tell them to shut up and drink it. I am going the classy route because I ran out of beer last night, and I have one of the finest. I believe this is a 2016 box of Cabernet Sauvignon. I believe it's a black box, one of my personal favorite brands. Doesn't necessarily imply that I like or dislike freedom, but it's getting the job done. I haven't had dinner and I had an early lunch, so this is going to go downhill quickly. And just to make sure that I'm staying humble, my backup drink that I just found right next to me is a prickly pear ranch water. So that I can drink the minimal amount of alcohol while being hungover tomorrow, just mixing for no reason.
Playing it safe.
2016 is a really good year for boxed wine. It's really high. Yeah.
Yeah. From the Surrender version or place of France. God, I had a good French surrender joke in there and I panicked. So, all right, what are we talking about? We're talking about lacrosse, Kevin. Next topic.
Boys, it's playoff time. Quarterfinals, not really quarterfinals because there's not four matchups, but I like to call it the quarterfinals. We got a couple great games, and we got Chrome Chaos. So, well, I'm looking forward to all three, honestly. I got to send my chirps in, but the two-seed Chrome is playing seventh-seeded, the defending champs Chaos. Then we go to the number three seed Archers versus the six seeded Redwoods. And we finished the day off at Gillette Stadium with the 4-5 matchup of Atlas Water Dogs. Guys, what are we most looking forward to? What game are we most pumped for? Let's start with you, Arestra.
I think my favorite game of the weekend is the Archers Redwoods game. I think there's like a couple of like fun little stories to this. One being that the Archers, when it comes playoff time, they're 1-3 in elimination games. They've got this stacked offense every year. They're really great at every position every year. Their only excuse every year has always been that, you know, it's tough for them to win faceoffs. They always struggle taking faceoffs. But, I think with that group this year, you need to kind of wonder when they're going to get over the hump. And if they're not going to do it sometime soon, then you have to wonder maybe is it time to, you know, shake the roster up, shake the coaching staff up, whatever it might be. So there's that for them. And then for the Redwoods, I think that's a team that, can play a little bit angry. I think Pinnell's been like incredibly hot. I think Charlie Bertrand's he's your kind of your breakout player of the year in the PLL, at the midfield. And I don't think they get, I don't think there's enough people considering them as a possibility to make a run in these playoffs. They're good everywhere. Like you can't find a spot where there's really going to be need for improvement. The thing they're going to have to deal with this weekend, of course, is the news today that Eddie Glazner's out. But you know, I think that game, there's two teams there actually that have a little bit of something to prove. You know, early in the year, as the Redwoods kind of stunk out the joint in their first couple games, you had social media and you had some other, you know, the lacrosse Discord, the PLL Discord, saying they should, you know, get a new coach and trade everybody and maybe they're tanking. And, you know, it sounded like ludicrous to me, and it still kind of does. I still think they're a really good team. So for me, that's my my favorite game of the weekend. Are the Archers getting over the hump? And are the Redwoods gonna start their run here with, you know, taking some of the hot players they've got and turn it into playoff wins?
That's a great answer.
Just to piggyback off that, I'll keep rolling there because I think that's the game that I would pick. But for the sake of mixing it up, I'll talk a little bit about the Chaos game. Defending champs, right? Like, this is their time where they shine, right? Every time they get into the playoffs, their back's against the wall. They have a chance to, you know, make a run, and everyone's doubting them. It's always a, you know, fun storyline to watch. Whether it actually happens or not, it's a fun storyline. So we'll just have to see if they have one more run in them or if it's just one and done this year and it's a whole bunch of noise that never came to fruition.
Now they're 2.8% only believe.
Yeah, Kaplan's in the 2.8%.
I don't know that I'm taking them to win. I'm just saying I'm intrigued by that game.
Nick, you look annoyed. How annoyed would you be if Chaos win?
This whole 2.8% thing, like, I have my tap dance shoes on, and if the Chaos lose, I'm going right to their grave and doing the two-step right on top of it. So I already saw, like, Jared Newman going, like, the chirping Diggs tape, you know, what, you don't believe in us? You were wearing a Chaos hoodie a mere 4 weeks ago. It's like, dude, that's the whole reason why you guys are brutal, is because you have this underdog mentality on a team that literally won the championship under the same circumstances last year. Stop pretending like nobody believed in us, really, because every team has multiple, like, all-stars, D1 All-Americans. You have Josh Byrne and Blaze Reardon. Shut up. That being said, that times up nicely. I will talk about Glazner's absence and what it means from a player perspective, because that is a huge bummer in a little bit. But my game to watch is the Water Dogs Atlas. And I think because that has the highest potential to be a beautiful shit show. I don't think any lead is safe enough for the Water Dogs to climb out of. And conversely, I don't think any lead is safe enough for them to blow it. I mean, they're, like, you watch one quarter, you watch one possession of the Water Dogs, you're like, this is the PLL championship team. And then you watch the very next possession, and they're like, this is a group of infants crawling around in diapers that don't understand the sport of lacrosse. What I'm most curious about is, obviously, the Atlas are going to win the faceoff battle, and the Water Dogs lose games when they give up goals off of the faceoffs. Like, there's just no other way to say it. It's why they lost to the Chrome. I'm hoping someone on the Dogs has enough foresight to say, hey, guys, we know we're going to go about 20 to 30% in the faceoffs. Let's just limit how much that hurts us and play good team defense, because the Atlas have cooled down from an offensive perspective and people starting to crack the code. Their midfielders aren't really producing at a rate that I would say is consistent enough to really put a premium on them over shutting down the attack. So I would just say, listen, let's slide early. Let's slide off into the attack. Let's make the midfielders beat us, because they've kind of had weird lineups going on the entire year. A lot of the midfielders I know personally are like, I don't know if I'm playing it or not, all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to say that has the highest shit show potential. And I love a good gong show.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you. I love the middle of the field matchup with these two teams. I kind of like how it's ordered with games from games I'm least interested in into the game I'm most interested in, for the reasons you guys outlined. But the defending champs angle is always interesting. The Redwoods, I think, are one of the most interesting teams around, with their poor start and Rob Pinnell just killing it the second half of the season. But the middle of the field matchup with, I think, Brian Costabile's, you know, he was so important to their success last season that he hasn't really hit that stride this summer. But like you said, it's kind of with the offensive chemistry in that midfield production has been so inconsistent that you look at the other side of the field, that's starting to see the same trend with the Water Dogs, right? They were hitting.
Well, it's a hell of a bet to make if you're the Water Dogs. And it's one that I would make if I was Copeland, is saying like, hey, what would we rather give up? A lot of consistent one goal points from Eric Law, from Chris Gray, from Jeff Teat, who also was underrated. Or do you want to give it to Costabile and Romar to shoot absolute piss missiles on the run? Like, that's not exactly something that you want to have happen, but given how the season is gone, all right, let's let Costabile and Romar beat us before we let the trio that has decimated defenses beat us. Something that I wouldn't have said last year at all, but this year it's like, let's give it a shot.
Yeah, and in that last matchup, they kind of burnt them a bunch with showing too far to those guys, like make them earn those unassisted dodges. They got them a couple times on wings where they would, the on ball would do a good job of forcing him under. They'd show just a little bit too much, and it would give a little bit of space for Gray on those cutbacks to the same side where the throwback came from, back to his left hand. And then the same thing on the other side, they hit Teat on a throwback on the same exact look for a step down. If they limit that and just don't show as much, learn from those like they did throughout that game, like trust yourself, trust Dylan Ward to make saves on, you know, those dudes that are, you know, he can track the ball the whole way and the ball's in their stick as they're taking 10, 15 steps on the run.
Yeah, worth calling out that Wardo plays the highest arc of anyone in the PLL, which leaves him susceptible to backdoor feeds, but puts him in a great spot for, you know, people taking long on the run shots.
Kaplan, just, we were talking about it offline here. Just,
it's cute.
How ridiculous was Dylan Ward's arc in Seattle?
Oh yeah, we made the joke that he was like, we just kind of assumed he couldn't see the ball inside there with the like weird stadium. So instead of like trying to play goalie, he just became like a 17, 16 soldier and just charged the ball. Literally just like ran at it. Like a blitzing linebacker, like Ray Lewis. He's the,
I love 17, 16.
He just goes, you know, like
Operation Human Shield.
Yeah.
Nick, you were there. He's playing the 2-point arc. That's when he's just sidestepping around on the 2-point line.
Try to block people from the 2-point line. Love it.
The other thing I'll add to this game here, I actually like the Water Dogs at the X against Baptiste. Like, he may win the draw as much as possible, and you know, like he's going to win his fair share of draws, obviously. But Water Dogs won't be scared to go to a double pull. Zach Currier, in Baptiste's own words, Zach Currier essentially is another pull. So like that group up there, that Canadian trio, they do a good job of getting on the same page and at least making him like work to the point. But by the end of the game, like hopefully he's just completely worn out if you're the Water Dogs.
I think part of the thing with that is that like, Baptiste's exits this year have been like just insanely fast and insanely clean. And like everyone knows kind of the Water Dogs deal, like Wiz isn't out there to win clamps. Like his clamp win percentage is always just like, you know, near the bottom of the league. And Tucci's even the same way. He's out there to make your face-off specialist life just absolutely the worst thing ever until Rylan Reese and Zach Currier to get there to make it somehow even worse. So like that's the plan. But Baptiste he wins the clamp and he's out so quickly that like I think it could be like what you saw week one with the Water Dogs, where Stephen Kelly had like a ridiculous first half because his exits and his ability to get the ball out quickly before the wings could even help just like let him just lead these runs. You know, he's winning the ball and it neutralizes the wings because they just don't have a chance to get there and impact the play.
And Baptiste is just,
yeah, Baptiste is like it's so smart with the ball now and the way he stays on and plays that like if you don't do the sub game right, or if you don't want those guys trapped on, like he'll punish you like crazy. He can handle the ball inside. It's because he's playing all this box now and he looks like a transition box player after he wins a faceoff.
Yeah, you beat me to the punch there, but Baptiste box exit strategies, like he's not, I wouldn't say revolutionizing the faceoff position because it's no, you know, you don't have to revolutionize exits. Once you win the clamp, go and get possession. But I would say that this year, more than any year that I can remember, maybe that year Garenlian had like, you know, won the MVP. he's perfect. Like, we are watching a season of perfection, specifically on the exits. And combine that with his box vision and IQ, which historically has never been a problem to face off. Like, I remember facing off against him in college, and he was like, win the face off and then get off and don't say a word. Don't even think about going to the cage. And now he can realistically play a two-man game on offense. Like, what the Philadelphia Wings have been able to do as far as like making him a threat and developing his box skills, it's no question he's the MVP of this season for me. And I think that if he doesn't win it, I'm in Portland right now. I'll just go join the riot down the street. And no, it's to Dan's point, it's extremely difficult to scheme against. The thing that you can't have is goals off of faceoffs. Listen, win 100% and give us a chance to place, you know, 6-on-6 versus let's go 60. Let's lose 60-70% of the time, but give up 3 or 4 goals. I'll take that 6-on-6 chance any day of the week.
Now, would he get off immediately after winning the faceoffs in college because he knew you were going to slide high and late?
God, I never got the chance to slide high and late to that. I can't say words like that on this family friendly podcast. And the worst part too, and this is what I love about the pros, is I think Tierney had him on such a tight ship when I was playing against him. I'm like, dude, you're a brick shit house. Really? That light tap in the back made you fall down. Like, he already understood the nuance of flopping. And as we were running off, I'd be saying the meanest, most horrific shit I could think of, and he wouldn't respond at all. Fast forward a couple of years when we were playing in the pros, I would say the same shit, and he'd maybe chirp back a little. Again, we're a family-friendly podcast. I won't discuss the logistics of what we were going back and forth, but maybe take 2 or 3 penalties in the first quarter to try and rattle him. Hey, lead with the crown of your helmet. Hey, baseball swing. Do something, because that's the only chance you have of stopping him is literally being Ed Reed. Not condoning any sort of injury, by the way, just condoning that to rattle his cage.
I can't imagine Baptiste chirping anything too harsh with his infectious smile and whatnot. But Nick, you're part of the Water Dogs locker room now. What's the vibe like? How are they feeling going into the playoffs?
Honestly, I think a big part, and here's like some actual analysis based off of funny situations. Copeland is probably the number one draft pick of coach you would want to grab a beer with after the game. And the dynamics
over
of just
Towers?
Over Towers, yeah. Towers, like, you can accidentally get injured very easy. Like, he'll throw you another round and that's coming at 98 miles per hour to your temple on accident. Like, but I really was, as much of a joke as it was awesome to watch these locker room dynamics develop. I was sitting there, you know, with Courier and Eli and Wardo and a couple other Water Dogs guys and Copeland literally felt like he was kind of, you know, one of the guys. And for him to have that one of the guys attitude while still having full control of his team, like, you know, you kind of get those good camera angles where he's like drawing plays up and he's kind of commanding the defense and stuff like that. Or just commanding his team. I think that balance pays off massive dividends. And I think that going into that, it's going to be a lot. You don't want to white knuckle the stick going into the playoffs. And you contrast that with the Atlas, where I think there might be some ruffled feathers on the midfield. I think there might not be kind of that laid back. Take it seriously, but don't over prepare and white knuckle and get so fired up that you just want to go out there and freak out. And I think the Water Dogs are going to find that perfect balance, leading them to like a 16-15 victory is my prediction. I think it's going to be a shootout, and I think it's going to be a disaster of a game. I can't wait.
Which is good, because I think you're right in that Copeland and maybe Sudo are definitely the two most personal guys as coaches in the league. And you look at the Water Dogs, this is the point I was trying to make earlier, and Arash to tell me if I'm looking too far into this, but you saw, so it was after Courier had that sweet swim dodge and underhand move to underhand low to high rip in that season finale. That was
stupid
that
good.
Yeah, it was so sexy. And he didn't get put in for the last play of the half, and he was like livid on the sideline. Water Dogs, they haven't been this healthy all season, but that also allowed Copeland to make necessary changes in the lineup, whereas now he has to really hunker down and figure out what offense best fits and will be the best offense to combat the Dallas defense. First, what is that best offense look like? How much does Sowers facilitate that? And how much am I looking into the whole midfield lineup situation?
No, I think that's an awesome question. And to Nick's point earlier about them playing with inconsistency, like, it's such a double-edged sword, the difference in personnel they've had. Like, it makes you a bit harder to scout. It's harder for the defense to know what's coming from possession to possession. But at the same time, from an offense, like, you need chemistry as well. So, like, not having as many possessions together as a unit could end up hurting on the other side. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword for me.
You know, I think the way that Copeland has built that team is it's to make it as versatile as possible. You know, as Nick was talking about their defense a second ago, and I think for this game, like, there's a strength there in that their three close defensemen in Eli and Burns and Randall are all pretty shuffleable in terms of who you would expect them to guard. Like, you can put them each on any number of kind of different guys. You know, you look at like the Chrome defense, you're like, all right, JT should guard this person, Manley should guard this person. Like, it just, this well, is I think how it should go.
Liam and Eli are shuffleable. I think Ben goes against the number one guy each time.
Well, I think when you look at the Atlas, you can put him anywhere, you know, like matchup specific. I think you could see him on T. I think you could see him on Gray. I think you could see him, you know, in a couple of spots. But to the offensive end and like the chemistry building, it's kind of like it's interesting in that they've done shuffling, but the guys that they have, I feel like they can still build the chemistry because, you know, like the guys just play everywhere. Like, do you want Sowers at X? Do you want him on a wing at attack? Do you want him to run out of the box? Like, the answer is yes, he'll do all those things. Connor Kelly is same kind of way out of the midfield. Or do you need him at attack? You know, do you need him here or there? Kieran McArdle, you can put him basically anywhere on the field. He's been productive doing absolutely everything this year. He's, you know, the only, him and Lyle, they're the only two 40-point players in the PLL this year. So I think they've got like this versatility thing where it's hard, yeah, to build chemistry when you have, you know, they've had injuries, they've had guys in and out, but that core group that's kind of shuffleable and movable and interchangeable around the offense, I think works well for them. I think it'll let them kind of maybe put guys, you know, to say, all right, if we want to dodge on whatever, on Dearth, and we know he's not as good on this part of the field, we have a guy at basically every spot who is comfortable at that part of the field. Like, we can put our offensive pieces anywhere. So I think that allows them to pick their spots a little bit in terms of, you know, all right, here's the weakness. Here's the guy we want dodging. I know he can attack from that place on the field. I know he can make them uncomfortable from there because, you know, it's Connor Kelly. You can dodge from anywhere, that kind of thing. So built the roster with that versatility.
And speaking of versatility, I honestly think that one of the Atlas have two of the biggest X factors in the entire game. Like, let's not forget that if I'm a sliding defenseman and Connor Kelly is dodging on Danny Logan, I'm probably not sliding. Like, Danny Logan is having that good of a year where you're built to be kind of a versatile, shuffleable offense. But to your point where Trevor said, you know, oh, it's like having another pull out there with Courier. Bullshit. Like, you know, Courier's not a pole that can play defense to the same level of ability that that Danny Logan can. And I've been unbelievably impressed. Like, I watched him guard Schreiber and my jaw was on the floor. Schreiber ended up scoring on that play because he's was bred in a lab somewhere. But watching him guard that, I'm not sliding to Connor Kelly if Danny's on him. And I think that having that type of impact short stick D-Mitty, and I think he's one of one right now with the kind of season that he's having, is an incredible game changer. And honestly, if I'm the Water Dogs, one of the things that I'm trying to do is let's get Danny Logan on Ryan Brown, because, you know, let's have him try to close out on the shooter and have Ryan Brown shoot around him. Because I think that if you try to initiate from a midfield position while Danny's on, your midfielder dodging, I think that's significantly less successful, leads to more turnovers because of the type of year that he's having.
Which begs the question, are they better? It's like they have this double-edged sword. Are they better without Sowers down at attack now that McArdle's feeding so well from behind? Are they better without Ryan Brown, one of the best shooters in the game, at attack now that Connor Kelly was so good at the point when he was out? It's good problems to have when you have all these options. But to Dan, your tweets, just transition that before we transition out of this game, two of the most not underrated, but I think overlooked in terms of the end of season awards for the positional groups, with Connor Kelly not making the midfielders and Craig Chick not making the LSMs, was pretty crazy. So they might be out for vengeance, might be a good matchup to look out for. But let's work backwards and go into this Archers Redwoods game. And Kaplan, what are you looking for in this one matchup wise?
Yeah, so this one is interesting. I was just trying to do some last second fact checking here before I came on and made this point, but fortunately the stats backed me up. But I just feel like in the last few games that we've watched, especially relative to last year, just Ament's ability to turn the corner and score unassisted goals has been such a difference between last year and this year. Whereas, like, last year, every time he had the ball, the off-ball defense had to help because he was a threat to, you know, initiate, turn the corner, and score. Like, if you think back to, like, him making Earhart fall and, like, taking his right hand and just sticking it, like, I feel
Jake
like...
Jake Higgins shut him down.
Yeah, I feel like that version of Grant Ament, just, you know, the part of it being the injury early in the year, whether he's struggled to get into a groove or he's just, you know, still nursing it a little bit, so not quite as explosive. But because he hasn't been able to, you know, produce the type of unassisted shooting numbers that he typically has, I think we're going to end up seeing the ball fall in the sticks of the midfielders a lot. Teams have been short sticking the Archers recently, so getting it either on Holman or on Manny. And so I think if we see a short stick go down to guard Holman, we're going to end up seeing a whole bunch of two-man, like, on the high right corner with Schreiber and Holman over there, rather than seeing Ament, like, you know, initiating a whole bunch. And I just think that if they can go into the game with that as the plan, knowing that that's kind of going to be the scout, that's going to set themselves up for success.
Ament and I saw Rob Pinnell, they're good buddies. We're having an Instagram live together, so I didn't notice Ament and Scott this blonde hair dyed hair now this summer, so he's got that and the stash look. He's like a totally different guy from the Penn State days. But I think seeing his, like, mentor, so to speak, on the other end of the field probably will ball out. Well, it's gonna be, I think he's going to be extra motivated to do pretty well.
Yeah, I kind of like, you know, I'd like to see him kind of be more involved and be more assertive. You know, he knows, and I'm sure the whole world knows, it's going to be Eppel back there on him, which is going to make life hard. Like, Eppel's a DPOY candidate, and rightfully so. You know, to Kaplan's point, you know, I wonder, knowing that it was a hamstring injury and it kept him out as long as it did, you wonder if it's all the way healed, and you wonder how much he maybe trusts it. You know, injuries like that, it's so easy to re-aggravate them, to just take a step that doesn't feel right. You don't trust it all the way. It's tough to come back from that, even when you're cleared, to really feel like good about going full speed. So, you know, I wonder if maybe there's some of that going on there, but you know, last time these two teams
played, we haven't seen him take, like, any long dodges, like, no dodges where he's, like, gone into it with, like, a 10, you know, yard head of steam and just been able to split to either direction the way that he used to kind of get going into it before he kind of made his move.
You know, the last time these guys played, Holman was like lights out. He had 5 goals on 3-1s and a 2. You know, I think those came on like 7 shots or something. Like he couldn't miss. He was, I think to your point, if you see that again, where he gets shorted and they play 2-man games with him over there, it'll be that kind of thing again, where he'll get a ton of looks. You know, I was looking into this today because I actually, you know,
the Redwoods, I feel like the Redwoods have, I worry about their short sticks the most outside of maybe Jack Neer.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was getting is, I don't know if they'll want to do that, just because, you know, do you trust IDA and Neer to be able to handle Holman or Manny or whoever they decide to do it? But, you know, looking at this a little bit today, because I was doing, I actually am on Marcus Holman over 2.5 goals this weekend at plus 160. Folks, that kind of value, how can you not be? But, you know, I think you look to it like the Archer shooters, like historically against Jack Kelly, are really not very good. Like Will Manny for his career against Jack Kelly is a 7% shooter. He just, it's like Kelly just seems to have his number. You know, Matt Moore went 0-for-3 the first time they played. Connor Fields went 0-for-2. Schreiber's a 25% shooter against Jack Kelly. Like Jack Kelly sees the ball well against these guys. The only one with a really good record against him is Holman, who shoots 50% for his career against Jack Kelly. But like, you know, I feel like there's these weapons all over the field. But Nick, this is where I would love to hear from you about the Glazner absence. Like if you're out there and you don't have the voice of Eddie Glazner behind you to get organized and have help ready for these kind of matchup issues, like how much does that throw you off? How unusual is it?
Ryan Kennedy.
D3 love.
This is the worst matchup to have Glazner out. This or the Whipsnakes, I would say. And to touch on a couple of those points, like I think it's played out that Eddie Glazner is the air traffic controller in the organization role. But I think as it relates to this matchup, like Glazner's been playing against these guys for so long that he would literally tell me where to be before I even knew that that's where I needed to go. Like Glazner against the Archers and the Water Dogs takes it to a next level that blows my mind. And I think what's really interesting of you guys calling out the short stick D-mid is, yeah, I think Neer and IDA are fine, but they're playing this weird hybrid where they'll have Perkovic, they'll have Nakai down there playing, obviously, in order to push transition. That's a much riskier bet against this offense-heavy Archers team than any other team. You know, if a guy like Nakai is out there, this offense is smart enough to not only recognize that, but to execute it at a much higher level than other teams. So the Glazner presence is going to be missed drastically. And to talk about, you know, some of the other communication gaps, Arden Cohen, I don't think he's at a level where you can realistically expect him to communicate and be as efficient. Because when you play a team that is as ball heavy and as talented as the Archers, you're like, all right, just make them make as many passes as possible and let's give up a better shot than someone right on the doorstep. Because to your point, Dan, Jack Kelly, I think he's starting to heat up a little bit. I think that the Redwoods sucking ass in the first couple games was – it wasn't talked enough how bad the goaltending was. You can blame a lot of different factors. The offense stunk, everything stunk, but the goalies really took a, you know, filled up their diapers in the first couple games. So it's nice to see Jack Kelly start to get this momentum, because having played in front of him, I see someone winding up for a 2-pointer and I'm like, you're an idiot. Like I'm going to start pushing, you know, and breaking out. And I think that they're right on the cusp of getting that same level of confidence, but without Glazner, it goes back down a little bit. So this is a game that I'm extremely worried about for the Redwoods from a 6-on-6 defensive perspective, because of the lack of communication from Glazner and Finn Sullivan and Arden Cohen's tendency to not be as dialed with that defensive unit as the, you know, as the Apples and, you know, quite frankly, as the Notre Dame grads who, you know, got it pounded into their head for 4 years. Combine that with the iffy short stick D-Mitty plays, where who is it if it's not Neer or IDA? It's someone that's going to get taken advantage of. And, you know, I think there are going to be some possessions where it's like, holy shit, how did it look that bad? And it's just going to be a let's bend, but try not to break. But the absence of Glazner cannot be overstated enough, particularly for this matchup.
You know, and I think something that can cover it a little bit, not even just the defensive end, but, you know, TD, this was a matchup he crushed in their first game. I think he can have big edge there. And if he can be in like the mid 60s, which is like, you know, big ask at the pro level, but if he can be up near there and take that many possessions away and give the defense that many, you know, breaks, I think he can cover that Glazner absence a little bit. But, you know, to Nick's point about Kelly getting hot, and I would throw TD in the mix there too, because, you know, you see it in like the NHL where like hot Dominik Hasek takes the Buffalo Sabres to the Stanley Cup final. Like, you can't look at this Redwoods roster and say like, all right, Jack Kelly and TD both get scorching hot. Who's really going to deal with that well? Like, who's going to be able to really give the Redwoods a big problem if Jack Kelly's seeing it well and TD's going 60%+?
And we saw it last year with Blaze. Blaze got super hot down the stretch. Next thing you knew, they were on top of the podium.
Yeah. So, you know, I think if Kelly can, if the two of them, Kelly and Erlen, have big day, I honestly think that could be as much as it really takes to cover that absence of Glazner and even, like, you know, get the Redwoods to a win.
Especially when you see Rob Pinnell do as good a job as he did against JT Giles Harris to end the season. That gives me a lot of confidence in him being able to at least produce a couple unassisted opportunities against Hasek.
He had four dimes against Hasek the first time they played. Like, Hasek didn't stop Rob Pinnell, really. So, I mean, I think you could even see that again. You know, do you see, you know, I tweeted it when the Redwoods were tweeting, like, how many goals for Garnsey this week? I was like, well, I'm looking at the data here, and the place where their archers are the worst, and they're the worst in the league, is against shooters from the low righty wing. So, you know, do you see Garnsey down there do some damage? Do you see maybe Matt Cavanaugh gets things moving where he's got his left hand to the middle of the field, and that's a spot where their archers don't defend all that well, and it's an opportunity for him, for, again, Pinnell to push. He seems like he can separate from Hasek and find some of these guys who can shoot. You know, obviously Henningberg will be in the mix too, but you know, I think that'll be exciting to see which Rob Pinnell you get. Do you get the JT Giles Harris Rob, where he's getting four goals, or do you get the Rob you saw from a couple games prior, where he's just throwing out assists left and right? It's been quite the year for him.
The thing that worries me about this Redwoods offense is sometimes, like, you know, I talk about inconsistency a lot, but I would say that more often than not, they rely on incredible individual performances is how I would say it. They were like, wow, the offense was really clicking. It's like, was it clicking, or did Garnsey just have two ESPN top 10 goals? Like, was it really clicking, or did Miles Jones have a ridiculous, he fell down past it and then shot a two bomb off of a weird last second? Like, it's been the biggest worry since game one. But especially in a game like this, I hate to even compare it because it was the dumbest way I've ever seen anyone win the championship, but you kind of have to be like DU years back. Listen, if you know you're going to win the faceoff matchup, the best thing that you can do is stretch out possessions and play really good team-oriented, patient offense. And it seems like the team-oriented, patient offense that the Redwoods play is move it around the horn. Oh shit, 10 seconds left, and now someone's falling into the middle of the field or taking a two bomb. So I would say, if there's something to call out, like, I've been begging for consistency on offense. Charlie Bertrand is the breakout player of the year. Like, are you going to have Cavan Ryder? Are you going to have Pinnell? Like, there are so many different variations of what this Redwoods offense has been. And a lot of it, as we've talked, it's not like, holy shit, their two-man game's looking good. It's Rob Pinnell played good this game. And I think that if you rely on individual performances like that, you could win, but it's not going to eat up as much of the clock, and it's not going to wear the defense down like you need it to once playoffs start.
No, 100%. It's
what a point by something me. We saw,
like, that was a really, really – that was A, well said. And
hey, have a drink. You deserve it. Well, good analysis from Nick. Oh, that's the ranch water. When you first said ranch water, I was like, did you put like ranch dressing and water and put it in a can? But that makes much more
Kevin,
sense.
Kevin, can you hop off? Water can from- you just hop off so that I can talk? You've never heard of ranch water?
What?
Never.
What?
No. So I'll have to check it out. Texas. Good old Tejas. Tejas made.
Ranch water.
Once you make it at home, you don't even have to buy the cans. Explore. Go get yourself some Topo Chico and some tequila and a lime. That's all it is. It's wonderful that you've never heard of it is incredible to me as well. It's like the most popular drink in the world right now. Everyone loves ranch water.
Well, there you go.
And
sponsor us.
You don't know what it is. You haven't ranch water.
Make it like a very exclusive drink. Ha ha, you haven't heard of us.
But, it's only 90% of us. Side alert, I keep doing this to my dad and he falls for it every time, but I'm like, Dad, I just don't understand it. What does Let's Go Brandon mean? I really would love to be a part of this super secret inside joke. He falls for it every time. So that's what ranch water is to me now. Like, you don't know what it means?
I feel like I'm always the, I don't even know. What are you referencing with the Let's Go Brandon?
Don't fall for it, Nick. Don't fall for it. Don't fall for it. This is such a Judo.
This is not a political podcast. Who'd you vote for, Kevin?
Anyway,
not to
the point you made about making it a team offense oriented Redwoods attack is going to be really important because, you know, coming out of a timeout, you see Miles Jones take a shot low angle down the alley. Nat St. Laurent references it after the game. He draws this very elaborate play to get this two-man game or something going on the other side, and he wanted Miles just to attack and move it. Of course, you want your star players to, like, get theirs, but it's a fine line between, you know, it's like Boyle said, like, it'd be a good shot if you made it, and because it wasn't, it didn't go in, it wasn't, so... It's just a tough line, and I keep going back to, you know, we saw one of the most historically great offenses this past college season with Maryland be super unselfish, and the way they moved it through X, you barely saw them attack through X with how much they got it through X and moved it to the other side so quickly. That was Pinnell's role for the first half of the season, and it kind of shifted that he had to take matters into his own hands. But the shift into our final matchup, that's really a main focus for Chrome. Nick Turn told me, he's like, yeah, it's pretty simple that Chaos, they slide in really unorthodox ways. And pretty much all we have to do is move it twice, find the matchup, and we'll be golden. And as long as they don't make a lot of mistakes, I think they're heavy favorites to win this. Hot take alert as the 2 seed versus 7 seed.
Don't let them hear that, or they're gonna.
When we show up to
Boston, what are you? One of the 97% of people who thinks they're gonna lose?
They're just gonna be waiting for Kevin.
Yeah, if they get totally shut down, it's gonna be mistakes that are gonna be their downfall. Though most of their mistakes are Nick Turner just jamming it inside to McIntosh and. I mean, let Dane Smith take care of all that jamming into the inside on the other end.
Yeah, Nick Turn, I mean, he should win Rookie of the Year. I said he should be up for Attackman of the Year as well. I think he had, like, that good of a season. But the knock is, man, he does lead the league in turnovers. He will cough the ball up a little bit. He had something like 33, 34 turnovers this year. So, you know, I think if they play defense in a way that, as you said, is unorthodox, I think the unorthodox nature of their defense is, well, Blaze Reardon's in goal, so we can just be like reckless and just chase sticks and, you know, try and send like super aggressive doubles. We can play for turnovers. We can do all this stuff, and Blaze is going to save the ball. So whatever, like, you can kind of have that approach on defense. And I think honestly, it seems like insane, but I think that's honestly how they play sometimes. Because you like their goalie just bails them out. But I kind of like some pieces of the Chaos in this game. I think Pat Resch, I wrote about that too, is having a great year as a short stick D-middy. If you had to guess who led that team and caused turnovers, you wouldn't be guessing Pat Resch. But if you said it, you'd be right. Like, that's insane to me with a team with Jack Rowlett on it, with CJ Costabile, you know, Newman down there. I know that people like to make fun of him as just like a guy who went DPOY for hitting twos, but he's honestly a pretty good on-ball cover defender. He is. Don't give me the look. He can guard the ball. I don't think the Chaos are getting necessarily like blown out here. I think Adler at faceoff does his best work in like the most high leverage of moments, even in those games where it seems like faceoffs go like close to 50-50. If you look like within the game at the individual draws that really, really matter in the course of a game, Adler is winning those or like very much contesting and in the mix on those. I think it'll be fun to see JT Giles-Harris guard Josh Byrne again. I know the first time out, the only way they really got Byrne to get looks was by freeing him with picks. He toasted Mike Messinger for that goal. That's obviously been on highlights everywhere. But other than that, he only had one other goal in that game, and JT won that matchup. We'll see.
I think the Chaos get blown out, actually.
You do?
I think they get blown out. I think it's Baptiste, Nardella, Farrell. If you're not one of those three, you're getting your ass beat at the faceoff X. Sorry, Max. I know we're former teammates, but not a great look. And I think really the biggest factor comes down to the Chrome short 60 middies. Not only for their ability to actually play good, cohesive defense, but I think they're a much bigger threat in transition. And I think that's been one of the biggest special team stories of the year is the Chrome's ability to not only score off of the faceoff with Farrell. Kills me to take Farrell over Max. I like Max so much more, and Max doesn't dress up in costumes and blah, blah, blah. But Farrell's starting to become much more of a threat. They're starting to know that they can score goals off of faceoffs, and they're starting to know that they can score goals in transitions. You look at the Chaos games, they're low-scoring, pretty close games. So it's going to come down to one or two different things, and the X factor being faceoffs and special teams. I'm going to give it to the Chrome, and I think the Chrome win this game by 4 or 5. It's going to be like a relatively boring 11-7 game where it's 11-5 halfway through the fourth quarter.
Big blowout there.
Well, when it's a low-scoring game, a 5-goal differential is a lot different, Kevin.
4-goal, but proceed.
Depends on how you do math. Carry the 3.
For sure. It's going to be interesting. Like, who guards Dylan Malloy? They've been putting LSMs down at close D for the second half of the season, it seems like. Troy Ray going to handle that matchup? They push in transition with.
Get Matt Reese down.
You would put Matt Reese on him?
Big fella. Strong kid. I could see that being a good matchup for them.
If you put Ray on Malloy, you just got to get the biggest guy. So, Dan, I hate to agree with you. Come on. But there's nothing better than a mismatch on Malloy where he gets to play bully ball. That's one of the most beautiful things in lacrosse is just Dylan Malloy going, I'm going to go this way, and you're going to get put on your ass. Mm. It's great.
But while we're all agreeing with each other, I'm going to agree with both of you guys about settled defense being in favor of the Chrome against those sets. I think that the Chrome are one of the first teams, at least the first that I noticed it, and they referenced doing it in the postgame, but pulling the lefties. So whichever lefty rolls out through the midfield gets the pull, knowing that their short sticks can go and guard Dane as a righty. But then you're just limiting all of the pick play and all that extra stuff that they can do if you do have a short stick on a lefty to go work with Byrne over on the other side. And so I think that's one of the reasons that the Chrome were able to kind of handle those looks. But it's a big ask to put a short stick on Dane Smith, obviously one of the best midfielders in the league, and a real feeding threat when you have so many good off-ball guys too. So it's a tough ask, but I think it's the smarter play, and it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. But knowing how good the short sticks have been for the Chrome this year, it's probably a safe bet.
I saw that Scannone too is saving like north of 70% against shots from righties or shots from the right side or something like that. It was like, all right, well, you better get those lefties. Like, do you dress even extra lefties? Do you want to just go as lefty as you can? I mean, just do nothing but attack the left side like crazy and see if you can make them change matchups that way. Because, you know, it's the way Scannone sees the ball. It's kind of like just if you're playing percentages, it's kind of where you should be attacking from. It'll be interesting, I guess, to see how the Chaos decide to attack that. But I would also say that some of the points being made about why the Chrome were so favored were made about why the Whip Snakes would be so favored in the title game, and look where that got you.
Yeah, a one goal loss last year from a team that's been beating the shit out of everybody. I'll take the reasons why they would win over the one fluke why they lost by one goal.
They didn't lose by one goal.
Who?
The Whips in the title game?
Wasn't it a close one?
It finished, I think it was like 14-9. 14-10.
Depends on how you do the math, but I don't think that's right. I think it was a two-goal game.
No, I think I'm right. I remember this because I think the Buffalo Bandits tied the Whip Snakes, and the rest of the Chaos provided the advantage, the winning margin.
Nah, I don't know. Depends on how you look at the numbers.
2 point here.
Can't do math. All right, since we're all in agreement with pretty much going chalk across the board with these picks, besides a couple of us like the Redwoods. I like the Redwoods. What would be the more interesting semifinal matchup for you guys? Chrome versus Redwoods Archers or Whip Snakes versus Atlas Water Dogs?
I'll take Whip Snakes versus Water Dogs again for just like maximum insanity out of field.
I think that was my answer.
Yeah. I think that would be fun as hell. And I like those matchups in that game too. There's a lot of cool stuff.
Last year's semifinal, right?
Yeah. I think the Whips won that pretty handily. But yeah, yep. I think that would be a ton of fun. What were the other ones? Let's see. Redwoods would go on to play. Archers would go on to play. None of those would be as fun to me as Water Dogs Whip Snakes.
How interested are you in the whole, like, can the Archers get over the hump storyline?
I legitimately am, because I know we're not talking about like the NBA or the NFL here, but a ton of really important players on that Archers team are free agents after this year, and free agency is starting in the PLL. The Redwoods too, but all three short stick D middies, Holman, Manny, Connors, there's more guys that I'm forgetting that are like impact guys, Connor Fields, like all those guys are free agents, and every team in the league is going to be interested, I'm sure, in at least some of those short stick D middies. Like, you're telling me other teams that's such a position in demand aren't going to be trying to sign Dominique or even Latrell Harris or even McNeil. Like, I think if you have a salary cap thing happening, and who knows what these guys are making, so who knows how much cap room they have and all that, but I think they could be up against it to keep everybody. And if they can't, then you have to make some decisions about what else you're going to do with that team. How many other guys are you keeping? Do you start trading guys too to try and make picks that, you know, will make sense? Do you try and trade yourself into a position where you can get a Sisselberger or if Luke Wehrman comes out, he could if he wanted to. Who knows if he would? But, you know, like, do you start making those decisions? But I honestly think the free agency thing looming, again, with the caveat that this isn't the NBA where, like, there's a supermax deal looming out there for Marcus Holman or something like that. But with that there, I think that's a consideration, that this might not be a team that looks like this after this year.
We do need more Utah Jazz, like something's going on with the Jazz and Donovan Mitchell trades in the PLL, I will say. But I like that stick with the free agency looming. It'll be interesting to keep track of with because we've had this knock against the Archers since the inception that Stephen Kelly couldn't get it done in the playoffs, and you trade him away and it's like, all right, well, go ahead, Rook. Go go improve our postseason chances. So.
Yeah, they've tried a lot of guys, and then Inacio didn't get any favors done because he had all that visa stuff to get sorted out in the beginning, so he missed a bunch of games. And I think faceoff is one of the harder spots, it seems like, to get acclimated going from college to pro. A lot of the other positions, I think you see guys pick it up pretty quick.
He's been improving, yeah.
But faceoff, I think takes longer. Faceoff takes longer, for sure.
Yeah, it sucks, but there's no other way for me to say things honestly than I want Water Dogs Whip Snakes. That's the number one matchup that I want to see this playoff. Again, just let chaos reign. I think that the Whip Snakes have the advantage over every team in every area on the aggregate, but I think the Water Dogs have the highest peaks of damn near any team. Just let's let the dogs play, let them loose, let them out, let them stretch their legs. I still think at the end of the day, it is, you know, oh, wow, hot take alert. It's the Whip Snakes championship to lose. Hate them. I think free agency needs to
blow up their team. But you think Water Dogs have the best chance to be there?
The best chance to make an entertaining game out of it, whether they win or not. I mean, I would say that the Redwoods would probably lose to them by one in heartbreaking fashion. I think that the Dogs have the chance to beat or lose to anybody 15-16. And I love that for them.
Big time. All right, let's wrap with I think we all have seen the Fate of a Sport film, now available on ESPN Plus streaming, and will be preceding the semifinal and championship on ESPN Plus or ESPN and ABC respectively, if I have that correct. Guys, what do we think of it? Let's start. I mean, Arash, if you want to start us off with some of your thoughts, you had a nice little write up of it.
You know, I'll just read the whole thing here. Hold on 1 second. You guys have a little bit of time. No, I mean, I thought, you know, to just like the brief synopsis, I think more than anything, I know it was meant to be, or it seemed like from the beginning, this is a story about building of the PLL. But for me, it kind of became story of, all right, here's a person who's trying to build a business, both as an employee and an owner of that business. And it's very atypical because the business is a professional sports league that he has to, you know, Paul Vrabel has to play in it. And he has to run it and grow it and have all these things happen. And it's balancing those two roles against each other is really, really hard. And I think over the course of the doc, you kind of see that it's not really possible, that it's not really a tenable thing to do. It kind of, you can either be the executive who's working really hard and growing it and your play on the field kind of suffers. Or, you know, I think if he was to maybe not work as an executive so hard and focus him completely on his play on the field, he probably would have played better, particularly in like that bubble season. But then the league doesn't grow, you know, like he's got to spend that entire offseason. I know he's like a machine, but if he's trying to set up a bubble in Utah for an entire league, how much time is he really spending able to perfect like play on the field? So I think you saw him kind of wrestle with the two roles together, and then ultimately, as his body breaks down, he chooses to be the executive. I think from that point of view, it is an entertaining and a really compelling kind of character study about this guy who's trying to make this thing work and burns the candle at both ends while he's doing it. And it's really, really hard to do. And in the end, he kind of makes this impossible choice to say, I'm retiring, even though I just had an all-pro season and I can probably still do it because my body is giving out and I really have to put everything I have into growing this league if it's going to succeed. I think one thing about it that I kind of, you know, and I wrote about this, had a little bit of an issue with is in the beginning, you kind of lay out, here's what the MLL was like for these guys and why these players felt mistreated and why it wasn't any good. And it was, all right, look, these guys all have two jobs. Like they're not really pro athletes, or, you know, travel's really hard, or, you know, compensation stinks and they, you know, all this other stuff. And in the end of the movie, you kind of, you know, leave out that almost every player in the PLL still has two jobs. Like that's still a thing. I still hear horror stories from players about how travel was a nightmare and they didn't maybe get as much help as from the league as they thought they might. And, you know, we had a team for a weekend this year use an auditorium with the curtain drawn as their locker room. Like, we still have some of these things that we're working through where the facilities aren't great and all that kind of stuff. And they bemoaned the MLL games all being paywalled, but, you know, the vast majority of PLL games are paywalled too. It's all better. The comp is obviously better. There's, you know, guys are making much more now than they were. The facilities are better. They're playing in cooler venues. You know, the treatment of the players on the whole has taken a great leap forward from where we were with the MLL. But I thought it was maybe a little unfair to be like, everybody needs two jobs and it sucked. Well, everybody still needs two jobs. You know, we're not quite there yet. Maybe a little nod to like, all right, here's how far we've come. We want to get to here. This is how we're getting there. Like that kind of thing, a little more nod to the future would have really put a bow on it for me. But on the whole, like I said, I think for me, it became really a compelling character study of this guy wrestling with how he's going to get this league built and accomplish this dream with his brother after coming from this place that really, really was a struggle and trying to do it with two roles that at times become basically like opposed to one another.
Yeah, no, I'm always a big fan of all the behind the scenes and details of a lot of financials. Like a lot of people tweeted up about the MLL offering 35 mil and them turning that down and then buying them for 1 mil a couple of years later. But Nick, I'm really interested in your perspective as a midfielder who played in this league for the first two seasons. How much did you
documentary?
Right, and the punch was in the documentary three. Excuse me. How much of a concerted effort were the Terps towards Paul?
I was also in the documentary. I just want to say, if you pause it when the Chaos are getting the trophy, you can see me standing in the front row. I was in the documentary.
Me.
Look at me, Louie.
No, so what's interesting about the documentary is I actually haven't seen it yet, but I recently watched the Manti Te'o documentary. And what's super interesting about that,
the whole pod.
If you catfish someone, you should be financially responsible for any dues that they take on. You know, Ronaya ruined his life and he didn't get taken in the first round of the draft. She should be financially culpable for that. And also the fact that she didn't show any remorse, what a scumbag character. So that's my review of Fate of a Sport, over to anyone else.
to the point you made about the MLL offer thing and all that. I did feel like maybe they didn't, I don't know if they treated BK too harshly or not with the clips that they use. I don't know what got left on the cutting room floor with Brennan Kelly's interview, but you know, I think they kind of used, there was like a soundbite where he was like, MLL's going to survive because we can keep writing checks and all that. And I think for a while at PLL launch, I think the MLL's plan legitimately was, this is something like, this is just kind of rumors I had heard, but their plan kind of was, okay, these guys launched this league and they're burning through cash at a remarkable rate. Let's just tread water. We have very, very deep pockets. And I think that was maybe the point that Brennan was trying to make, not speaking for him here again, this is just me, but we can keep just funding our MLL. And while they burn all this cash and we can just make the bet that we will last longer than they do, because we have a ton of money. And then, you know, obviously that all kind of changes after the first season because 2020 just turns the world on its head. But I think that was kind of the point that he was trying to make there, was that was the approach that the MLL was trying to take, which, you know, in 2019, maybe wasn't necessarily like the worst strategy in the world to think that might work. Obviously, we're where we are now, so it didn't work. We had COVID, we had everything else that happened in 2020. But, you know, I think that was the point he was trying to make, more than just being like, we've got a bazillion dollars and we're going to just buy the PLL one day or something. I think that was the way it kind of got taken. And I don't know if that was like necessarily the way it was meant to be. I don't think Sandy did himself any favors in the documentary, by the way. I mean,
that guy hasn't done himself a favor in quite some time. Yeah. I'm actually curious, after seeing the documentary, are there any questions from the player perspective? Who am I trying to help now? I'll fucking spill the beans on everything.
Did you get a letter from the MLL that was threatening legal action if you left?
Mm-hmm.
Because they showed that. And there's a moment where Paul is on the phone, I think, with Kyle Harrison, and Harry's saying, all these guys got this letter. They're worried. Like, what's going on? Was the temperature really like, oh, my God, this might not work. Maybe we shouldn't go? Or was it like, F this guy, we're out of here?
The fact that they threatened us with legal action when 2 years prior they accidentally leaked all of our addresses and social security numbers and everything, it was like, I looked into taking action against the MLL for leaking that because I was, young and, we're going to fucking take him down. But no, they were like, you're threatening us with legal action. Like, on what basis? Like, do you know how bad you've mismanaged our data? That's if they wanted to paint the MLL in any specific light, particularly a negative one, like, yeah, they didn't treat the players right and accidentally leaked all of their information to the public.
I actually, I kind of thought, and I wrote something kind of like that. I didn't mention the data thing specifically, but obviously that's something you could do. But while that was happening, I remember I spoke to Sandy for a podcast at that time, and he was like, saying all these things like, well, it's great. We still feel like we have the best players in the world, but you know what? A rising tide lifts all boats. And if the PLL does this, then good luck to them. And if they push us to like elevate the MLL product, then that's great. And everybody wins and there's room for two leagues and all this stuff. You know, that's the kind of stuff he's saying, like, to me as a media member at the time, while he's sending you a letter threatening legal action if you leave. I think having those two things in there together alongside that, all right, here's a letter the players got that says you're going to get sued if you're breach of contract, whatever. Alongside, all right, here's, by the way, what they were saying publicly, like, good luck to you. Everybody's going to get better from this. Like, okay, I think maybe you're kind of getting a feel then for some of the parties involved here and the character.
I wish I could go back and revisit, and I wish I took screenshots of like the conversations that were going on amongst players when it was officially announced. And it was like, hey man, where are you going? Those were some, like, the group chat was all time. Like, so yeah. I'm still in like a 2018 preserved in time Outlaws. This roster is preserved in this group chat. Nobody leaves. Doesn't matter what league you go to. I think it was Bocklet was like, we're not fucking leaving. And like in that first season, we were talking about the bubble, and there was all this media about PLL versus MLL, this and that. Meanwhile, like, all of us are texting our MLL buddies like, dude, that was sick. Like, did you see that guy get killed because you guys have opposite boxes? What the fuck was that? Because there aren't those mega contracts, it was honestly like the golden era for group chats. Like, when the names were announced, that Outlaws group chat, what the fuck is a whip snake? Enjoy your league, boys. That should almost be its own segment in itself, was like, because I know they had Romar on because Romar's all of a sudden clout king on Instagram, pew pew chirp. And it was like, yeah, I remember when Paul reached out and this and that. And I'm like, the amount of jokes that were flying around, because no one really cared. I was like, listen, we're all buddies. No one's going to – he chose PLL. Like, what a dick. Or he stayed in the MLL. What an idiot. It was like, yeah, man, what are you thinking? All right, go ahead and let's make this, like, the funniest, thing that's happened.
For the listeners, Nick, so I think what a lot of people get confused about is the fact that – so were you under contract with the MLL?
No, my contract expired, so I wasn't really. I mean, I still got that letter that was like, we'll sue you. And I was like, I didn't re-sign yet.
Because the fact that Lyle Thompson signed a long-term deal to make himself a hot commodity during the MLL days, the year before the PLL was formed, meant he had to stay in kind of MLL purgatory. And, there's plenty of other good players that like you were mentioning, that did stick with the MLL. Yeah, Dylan Malloy and kind of Michael Krause make the decision to go with Connecticut because it was closer to his home or his work. All these personal decisions are kind of being made, and it is kind of cool to hear that insight that, oh, it's like, hey, whatever's best for you, man. But explain that. Were
Nick,
you,
I need to ask you a question.
Everyone
about
that what made that initial switch over to the PLL was had their contract expired?
No, I mean, I probably would have gone over regardless, just because it was kind of like new and fun and exciting. And I mean, I think Mikey Schlosser is the perfect like test for this. Why didn't Mikey Schlosser go to the NL? Well, he didn't really feel like it. He was loyal to the Outlaws. Like, I played for the Bayhawks and Outlaws, two of like the premier, funny to use that word, like two of the best franchises in the MLL. So I always got treated fantastic. And like, I honestly think what the PLL completely misses out on is that type of culture where a small investment to pick up the bar tab and appetizers after a game goes infinity the long way. And when I was like, Mikey, why aren't you going PLL? He's like, yeah, well, you know, the Outlaws have always been good to me and they got Bud Lights, so why would I leave? And I'm like, fuck, man, I might stick around.
Nick Solo, watch out.
So that first year of the split, the Outlaws play the Bayhawks for the title. And I often think about like an alternate universe where the Outlaws basically don't get totally ref jobbed in the closing of that game and win the title. Number one, do you think all those guys from the Outlaws come that year if they actually win the title, or do they stay with the Outlaws? And number two, give me the highlights of the group chat following that game, of that Outlaws group chat.
So I don't think championship really matters on if you were going or if you were staying. And that I distinctly remember that day because we were all watching it. And we saw, you know, we saw Zach Currier like scream at the ref on the way out and this and that. The Outlaws group chat and almost every group chat is just pure comedy from start to finish. And then you take it seriously when there's a scouting report or when, hey guys, remember there's like a team Zoom or something. In a group that was notoriously not taking themselves seriously, which made us good, the Outlaws, that was the most hostile I've seen that group chat ever. The referees' numbers were getting posted. Family members were being brought up. Like we went into detective mode on everything about that ref's life, and relatively good reason. I haven't seen a ref job that bad in a long, long time. And like, because we were all reacting to it in real time. And then when like Currier got in and said what he was saying, like, you know, those text messages, whether it's a text or whether it's a GroupMe, someone says something and in 30 seconds, it has like 20 likes. It's like ding, 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 ding. Currier said something that was so mean and egregious about the refs. It was, you know, honestly, some of the meanest shit I've ever heard in my life. And it was like the most liked message in that chat's history. Oh, you ask him about that now, he'll sucker punch you. Or he'll flop when Garrett Apple touches his nose. Depends.
Who says the Canadians are always polite?
That's the biggest, I mean, yeah, the two biggest, I don't know, marketing agencies is, you know, one, whoever told you that, you know, you should start eating kale, that whoever did that deserves a round of applause. And two is whoever convinced the world that Canadians are polite. That's full of shit.
The Canadian lacrosse contingent on Lax Twitter all the time, whenever there's like chirping or like even a borderline play, the Canadians come out of the woodwork like, I'd fight that guy. It's like, oh yeah, he's real polite, real polite group.
That and like their proclivity to fighting and not understanding the jokes, it might as well be Germany. It's like diet Germany. We're gonna fight the world and not be funny. All right, well, good. We've seen that happen.
Love it. Well, can't wait for this weekend. Thanks for joining the PLL Happy Hour Podcast, Dan and Nick Kaplan and I will see everyone in Gillette Stadium. And thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, share, subscribe, tell your friends, and keep on listening.
This was a little happy hour. This got loose at the end. I liked it.
This was fun. Thanks for having me, guys. Make sure you follow me on Twitter at Nick Ocello.
Thanks, guys. Please direct all pictures of your feet to at Dan Arestia.